pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
For more than 5 decades, bobwhite quail populations have been suffering precipitous declines across their range. And despite being one of the most well-studied birds in North America, wildlife experts still don't have a real clear understanding of population distribution across the entire bobwhite range. To help close that knowledge gap, Quail Forever, the University of Georgia Game Bird Lab, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service partnered together about a year ago to create an app, the Bobscapes app. You gotta love that name, the Bobscapes app, as part of the USDA's Working Lands for Wildlife Initiative. Today, we're going to talk about the creation of the Bobscapes app, how it works, what biologists have learned in the first year of its usage, and how you, the On the Wing podcast listener, can help. We've got 3 featured guests today, and they're all returning guests. They've been on a number of podcasts. Leading off for us will be Dr. Jessica McGuire, Quail Forever's Quail Science and Working Lands for Wildlife leader. Dr. Number 2, Dr. James Martin, professor at the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources. Non-doctor, just like me, Ryan Sparks, editor of the Quail Forever Journal and a frequent Bobscapes app user. But before we get rolling, I do want to mention our Farming for Habitat campaign. That's Farming the Number 4 Habitat campaign. That is a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation making this podcast happen today. The Farming for Habitat campaign includes Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, Trout Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited, the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, the National Wild Turkey Federation, Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation, and the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies for the purpose of highlighting the investment private landowners are making in the conservation of America's fish and wildlife resources through USDA conservation programs like CRP, EQIP, Voluntary Public Access Habitat Incentives Program, you know it as VPAHIP, and a whole host of other federal programs creating wildlife habitat on private lands, which includes all the USDA programs creating habitat for bobwhite quail. You can check out the campaign at farmingforhabitat.org. All right, now let's get into those introductions I teased. It seems like 15 minutes ago after that introduction. First doctor, you guys remember the movie Spies Like Us? Doctor? Is that before your time? Chevy Chase, Dana? At least Sparks is shaking his head in affirmative. That's a classic from the 80s. First doctor on the list, Dr. Jess McGuire. You've been on before, but for folks that maybe haven't caught one of the podcasts, give an overview of who you are and what you do for the organization, Jess.
I am the Working Lands for Wildlife Bobwhite Program Manager and also Quail Science. So I've been with the organization for about almost 6 years now, and I spend my time in Georgia, but cover about 26 states, so get to go around a lot for Bob White, you know, spreading the word on Working Lands for Wildlife and helping states implement what we've got going on with our partnership.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us again. Dr. Number 2, from the University of Georgia, thanks for joining us again, James. Tell our listeners a little bit about you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Georgia, home of the real bulldogs. And I've been here about 10 years now. This October will be 10 years, which is really hard for me to believe. You know, been doing quail research since, I guess, formally, professionally, or getting paid to do it since 2003. Been at this a long time, and I'm starting to show my age, or feel it anyway. I don't remember that movie you referenced. That was maybe a little bit, I was too young in the early 80s. But, anyway, so yeah, I love doing quail research and upland game research, and also have bird dogs of my own. But I'm sad to report that my wife is limited. I've reached my cap on bird dogs, Bob. So I just don't have any room for those short hairs that you probably want to give me.
So how many bird dogs do you have at present, James?
Well, I have three pointing dogs and a retriever, a Cocker Spaniel. And, you know, depends on who you ask if you include that as a bird dog or not. But for being generous, I have four.
Okay. Yeah. And you are a very enthusiastic bird hunter as well. We've talked about that on many podcasts. What is on the horizon for you in the autumn of 2024 that's got you most excited?
Well, as we were talking before on air, you know, I'll take a grouse hunting trip, a rough grouse trip somewhere most likely. And I'm just waiting to see the survey data for some of that. I'm excited about potentially going for sharptails this year. Mm. I've never been on a sharptail focused trip. I've hunted them for like a day or so on various other trips, but thinking about doing a really focused sharptail trip this year. So that's got me excited. And all my dogs are in their prime, even though I'm not. So that's that's got me excited.
Yeah, dogs in their prime can make up for us not being. It's very similar to that Toby Keith lyric, "Ain't as good once." Yeah. "Ain't as good as I once was, but I'm good once as I ever was." Well, dogs can make that true for sure.
Absolutely.
Editor Ryan Sparks, I don't know. We're punching your frequent podcasting card like twice this month. You were on recently with Jesse Griffiths. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself if they didn't listen to that one.
Yeah, sure. Well, like you said, I'm the editor of Quail Forever Journal. So if you're a Quail Forever member, you're going to get that in your mailbox throughout the year. If you're not a Quail Forever member, I would highly suggest becoming one. One big benefit is to get that magazine and read all the great stories in there. Yeah, also got bird dogs, English pointers. Some people would get mad at me for saying English before pointer, but I'm not one of those people. And kind of travel all over the country chasing birds every fall. So,
you mentioned bird dogs plural, and I know you have Tippett, who's a frequent coworker of mine. When you mentioned it plural, do you have a puppy on the horizon?
I misspoke. I'm used to having more than one. It's one of the only times in my life I've only had one, but okay. I'm down to one. I had my name in for a couple different litters. Unfortunately, neither one of those litters took, so I'm still on the list, but it'll be plural in the near future.
All right.
Hopefully.
Well, I'm making up for you. I'm adding my third by the end of the month. Awesome. of July, so... nesting has begun in the St. Pierre household. And yes, James, it's a third short hair.
Misery loves company, I guess.
Well, all right. So we've covered bird dogs, spies like us. If you haven't seen the movie Spies Like Us with Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, two thumbs up from this Siskel and Ebert endorsement. You'll laugh, you'll cry. It's a triumph of the human spirit. All right, Bobscapes. So folks that are listening, you know, maybe get the laptop or a tablet in front of you, go to bobscapes.org and you can follow along. James, I mentioned in the opening, you know, that bobwhite quail populations have suffered sort of a precipitous decline over the last five decades. Yeah, give us, you know, when people ask you in the elevator, the classic elevator speech, where are bobwhite populations today?
Oh, where are they today? Well, from a spatial perspective, we have a few strongholds across the country still today. Parts of South Georgia, North Florida, parts of Texas, kind of the western half of Texas, and then across various parts of the Great Plains through Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, there's, you know, good populations still holding on, parts of Missouri. There's definitely, within each state, with few exceptions, there's strongholds of populations, and then those particular areas I mentioned earlier are doing really well. But as a whole, you know, as you mentioned, populations are been declining anywhere from 3 to 5% since early 1960s when we started monitoring through the USGS breeding bird survey data. Not doing well as a whole, holding on in some places, and in some places they're on the increase where there's been a lot of focus management. But the areas they're on the increase are very much a fraction of what they used to be. So not in great shape.
And, you know, obviously this is likely no surprise to any listener out there. And, you know, I'm going to lead Jess into what's also likely not going to be a surprise. Jess, tell us kind of, you know, we talked about the precipitous decline and where there are and where there aren't bobwhite populations. What's the culprit where there aren't, and what's the what's the reason why they're there, why they are in good places?
Yeah, so I mean, like all things that we talk about on the podcast, a lot boils down to habitat and availability for them to live out life cycles successfully. You know, they have a lot of things that want to eat them, so the cover needs to be suitable to hide them and provide, you know, food, shelter. And we've just changed the way that we've managed across the landscape over those years. And it's really, a lot of upland birds have taken a hit as a result. You know, you drive around Southwest Georgia and you see developments called Quail Run. Yep, because they had to run away. You know, there's just, you know, we're losing space for the birds quickly. And that's really the bottom line. You know, there is some things, different pressures in different places, you know, so like a good scientist, we always throw the word depends out there, you know, where we're talking about. But overall, you know, the number one is habitat, and that's what we try to fix first.
So in the intro, James, I talked about Bobscapes app is attempting to help identify geographic distribution of quail across their range. And as you alluded to in your introduction before we hit record, we were talking about drumming counts for ruff grouse, which is, you know, kind of a index that state agencies have been using to monitor populations in the ruff grouse range. And very similar in the pheasant range, states do rural mail carrier routes in the fall to monitor broods. And, you know, some states do two different kinds of quail surveys, a spring calling count, and then also that August roadside count for quail. So where does, so there's a lot of agencies doing different sorts of indexes to monitor populations. I guess, why isn't that enough, and where does Bobscapes come in to help fill some of the voids?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, all these survey instruments are like different tools in the toolbox, and each tool has its own pros and cons, or, you know, little niche that it tries to fit. You know, there's no crescent wrench out there that does everything, or my dad would use the WD-40 and the duct tape. There's nothing out there that quite does everything perfectly. So one of the gaps that Bobscapes fits is trying to get presence data, spatially explicit presence data from bobwhites on lands that are probably undersampled by these existing tools. And what I mean by that is many of these large-scale monitoring programs, like the Breeding Bird Survey, are done on roadsides. And they probably don't do a good job, or as good a job as we would like, of surveying, you know, the heart of a patch of farmland, because maybe a road doesn't go through it, or what have you. And so the target for Bob's case was private landowners that when they're out doing whatever they do on their property and they hear Bob White, they record it. And that spatial information that we get from that little pin that gets dropped, the XY coordinate, is really important, because unlike these other surveys where you have a spatially implicit, you're lacking spatial information of where the bird was actually detected. Bob's case, we have a good idea of, like, the bird was within this thicket or within this field. Whereas these other surveys, it shows up on a data sheet as two birds were heard at this point, but that point you're surveying maybe up to 200 acres, and so you don't know where the bird was within that 200 acres. Bob's case, or tools like it, we get a little bit better precision to the survey. And so we're just getting better coverage of areas where we think Bob Whites may be, and better spatial resolution. And Bob's case data alone doesn't, not going to solve all the problems, but when you combine them with other existing tools like eBird, with Breeding Bird Survey that I mentioned, and the data that the agency is collecting, those data sets together, when you integrate them, are really powerful. And so that's how we planned to use it. Not so much using Bob's case data by itself as when you look at it on the aggregate.
So is that where the University of Georgia comes in? And I'm guessing your grad students collect data from all those different sources, including Bob's case, and then that's the foundation of research, so they can start to decode all that data. Is that an accurate assessment where Georgia fits in?
Yeah, that's pretty good, especially for a guy that, you know, has a short hair. But
up high, down low. I love it.
No, if anybody, Jess has one too, but you know, we won't even go there. So we have postdocs here and students that are integrating those data, and we use models that other people develop for other species, particularly. At least Simpkins Lab and there in Michigan State has developed a lot of really good models for integrating multiple data sets. And so our job is kind of do that math and do the statistics and do the spatial part where we integrate those things together. And so Bob's case is one of those data streams, and also the Workland for Wildlife Outcomes Assessment, that monitoring that a lot of the PF and QF biologists are doing as well. So all of it kind of fits together. It's kind of hard, I think, for people sometimes to realize there is this grand puzzle and all of the pieces are getting put together. But and everybody's piece of the puzzle is really important. And it takes a little time to put the puzzle together.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And it occurs to me, too, did you say you started as a professor in 2003? Was that right?
Well, that's when I started graduate school. Graduate school in 2003.
Okay, so rough numbers, you've been in academia professionally 20 years. My perception in the last, say, 3 to 4 years, the value of citizen science, you know, has elevated or escalated exponentially. Like, people in your position now are like, yeah, bring the data on, like, let's put people that are curious and interested to work. Is that perception accurate, that there's been a groundswell of activating the general public around science that never existed a decade ago?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that term, 10 years ago, I don't know if you would have asked me what that meant, I could have told you. I could have probably just deduced it, or, you know, but I couldn't have given you a good example of it. And so, yeah, absolutely. 10 years ago, probably not would have heard of it. 5 years ago, would have heard of it, but never used it much. And then since the, you know, within the last 5 years, definitely exponential increase in the number of publications using citizen science data and the number of programs across the country, whether it be monitoring birds or butterflies or bees or what have you, using citizens is skyrocketing. And yeah, one actually, this little side story, one of the first times I saw it used was my mother-in-law was helping the Smithsonian ID plants, because hawthorns are her specialty. She's a trained biologist, but in her spare time, she was IDing plants on a webpage for free, just looking at the specimens. And I was like, what are you doing? She's like, I'm IDing plants. And I was like, really? From here in Georgia? The Smithsonian? She's like, yeah. I was like, okay, cool. So there's all kinds of little efforts out there that use, you know, the expertise that are all across the country to ID things or harness the power of the common person.
So I'm going to take it to the complete other end of the spectrum, stream of consciousness. You could probably predict where I'm going to go now, and that's artificial intelligence. You know, and I know, you know, we've talked about ARUs, so audio recording units that are just, you know, out on the landscape monitoring quail whistles. And I'm imagining that's collecting data and feeding into one of these data sets. But I'm thinking, you know, even to the next step, at what point are drones going to be flying in with thermal imaging, counting bobwhite quail, counting pheasants, counting sharptails, and just say, well, right now on the landscape in the state of Missouri, you know, there's 3.7 million bobwhite quail, and it's down to, you know, just single-digit accuracy. How far off are we from that kind of level of artificial intelligence?
Wow. Yeah, that's a really tough question. I think we're a long ways off, and I don't think we'll ever get. Yeah, I don't think we'll get there, and I hope we don't. And I, you know, I don't want to get too deep in my philosophy, but I do think there's a limit, a philosophical or existential limit of how we use drones and AI. There's super value in biologists getting in the field beyond just checking a box that I heard this animal or whatnot. There's something connection between nature and the human that we don't want to lose. And I would hate for that to be replaced entirely by a machine. And so philosophically, that won't be the case in my research lab. I can't control everybody else, but that, I know that's what I'll do. And then there's practical constraints of reasons why drones won't work at large scales, you know, battery power and these kind of things. You know, one of the powers of things like bobscapes is we're covering 28 to 30 states, depending on how you want to argue the bobwhite range. You know, we're covering that. There's no way you could do that with a drone unless you had Department of Defense type budgets. And then, you know, the thermal stuff, you know, that would really only work if you didn't have a lot of tree canopy. And so anyway, there's a lot of technical issues with that as well. So I think we're a long ways off for bobwhites, for species like that. Now, if we want to talk about species that may breed in the prairie where it's open and they're lekking, and you can fly over lek sites and what have you and count birds that way, we're probably a few years away from that being something that can be operationalized. But doing large scale surveys with drones, I don't see it.
So I totally get your philosophical, you don't want to take the human element out of it. We have the same discussions in marketing around graphic design. You know, the creation of art, which I would categorize as graphic design, is, you know, quintessential to the human element. But I think there's also like opportunity where there's gray area. Is there any gray area where you think, well, this would be advantageous to utilize art of, and maybe it's the ARUs. But areas where it would help leap forward a tremendous amount of learning for you?
I think in the way we categorize vegetation, so, you know, if there's a way that we could use someone's cell phone picture to scan a piece of property or stand, you know, scan where, take your phone out, do a panoramic view of where you're standing, and then you have a model, an AI type model that would then say, okay, this is 90% quail habitat or 10% or whatever, that would be super cool and interesting and useful. And I think that's possible in the next 5 or 10 years. I see AI as a really powerful tool for describing things. And that's to me where I see it being really useful.
Cool.
So that's low hanging fruit.
Yeah. Well, sorry to take us on an artificial intelligence tangent, but it is, it is fascinating because you do think about, or I think about all the applications that, you know, we could, I know that there are drones right now that, to an extent, they're measuring what you're talking about with habitat. Like, you fly a drone over a wildlife area and say, there are X number of stems of milkweed in this 500 acres. And that's valuable information to know, extrapolate, well, milkweed to monarchs equals X to the population. So there's probably progressions that that's going to take, and it does become a philosophical conversation between where's the human element end and where does, you know, or where do we need to end the artificial component of it and keep the human element. Anyways, Jess, you prompted this conversation now in mid-June around Bobscapes. You wanted to have this podcast for a very particular reason. Talk about why timing for this conversation is so important right now.
The peak calling, where all states have it in common at that point. You know, everybody should be hearing whistles right now. And if you're not, you need to look around at your landscape and come talk to us and figure out what we can do to hear more birds. But to really give a push to the Bobscapes app to get people more active and more engaged. And, you know, you talked about citizen science, and that's really the other important half of what the goal is for Bobscapes app, is to be able to reach people with something that they're hopefully really interested and provide more information to them if they request it. So on the app itself, you go through a series of questions, and there's a couple times where the user is asked if they want more information. And that's where we've been trying to, you know, follow up at least quarterly with the contact of people. So if they ask for information, we're connecting them with, you know, either their state coordinator in their state or a state agency in their state, whoever is more appropriate. And then occasionally sending out, you know, blasts to all the users, you know, reminding them that there are other resources available, whether through us, Find a Biologist, through Quail Forever, or going to their local NRCS FSA Service Center, USDA Service Center, or, you know, just doing some research on their own and giving them some new stuff to read. So really now is the time to be thinking about it. And, you know, in some parts of the country, like my backyard, we just hear bobwhite. It's something that I'm used to hearing. But it's also to ping people. If you hear it, it's really important that you're letting us know, because that's helping us focus some of these USDA programs with our partners. And it helps us focus where we potentially are going to fight to get biologists and boots on the ground and habitat team. So, you know, that's really big picture on how we can engage with the users of the app.
Let me backtrack just for a second for, you know, because a large portion of our listener audience is in the pheasant range, and they're thinking, wow, bobwhites are calling in mid-June. It's like, this is the peak of the hatch right now. I'm seeing broods. Just give kind of a compare and contrast for folks that are not as familiar with bobwhite quail's life cycle and reproduction. Like, the brood or the reproduction or the mating season, the nesting season is considerably elongated compared to what the pheasant range or the rough grouse range the northern listeners would be used to, isn't it, Jess?
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny because when we get together with other staff, Pheasants Forever staff, Quail Forever staff from other states, they're like, wait, what's happening in your state right now? You know, it's hard to comprehend that, you know, we're already seeing, you know, chicks on the ground in some places. And it varies depending on geography, where you are, weather, you know, especially we talked about that a little bit earlier. But, you know, in areas where it overlaps, we held a bobwhite boot camp in Missouri, and James helped lead that. And it was interesting to have those discussions because we did have pheasant at that site. And it was interesting to hear some of the biologists talk about the differences and kind of the expectations and the ability to nest multiple times. You know, bobwhite kind of have that longer window in most of their range to be able to do that. So I guess maybe that kind of summarizes it, but you know, they're very different birds out there on the landscape, and where management can work, you know, for both of them, for sure. But definitely different needs throughout their geography.
I was going to add a little bit more to that. I mean, bobwhite calling, it typically peaks when most of the hens are incubating nest. So it's a little bit, you know, different than pheasants, for that reason. And, you know, depending on where you are again, right now I have birds radio tagged in Indiana, Kansas, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina. The first nests in all those areas, with exception of Central Florida, were within days of each other. Central Florida birds nest about a month earlier, but throughout the rest of the range, it's pretty close to where nesting is fairly consistent. And again, peak calling for male bobwhites is when most of the hens are nesting, because they're basically out there trolling for another mate, because they do have promiscuous mating strategy. So, you know, basically from the last week, second week of June, or let's say to the end of June, calling is going to be prime for bobwhites. And then we'll enter a lull, and then you'll have a second peak, typically, you know, when hens go on their second nest, when renesting starts. So, you know, that's why right now I would think in your area, anywhere in the bobwhite range, you should hear calling if there are birds there. And that probably means there's hens incubating.
So I know with bobwhite, the male can play a role in the incubation process. Mm-hmm. Is that consistent where a male always helps incubate, or is that a sometimes sort of scenario? And yeah, how does that impact a male participating in singing? If they're incubating, they're not singing, and if they... tell me a little bit more about the male, yeah, and what's happening there that's a little bit different than maybe our pheasant listeners are used to understanding.
Yeah, the male bobwhites play a really crucial role in bobwhite mating, and it makes sense because they need some strategy to overcome high mortality. And one of those strategies is the males, depending on the year, can incubate up to 20% of all nests. So pretty significant. I have a student that's, you know, working on looking at how that male incubation strategy may affect population growth. So they're really important for that. They can take, we've had males take over for hens if the hen gets killed. So it kind of rescues the nest. That doesn't happen too often, but we've seen it. Males can adopt chicks from hens that have their chicks, or if a hen is brooding chicks and that hen gets killed, a male will adopt those. A male can brood chicks on his own. they're just very plastic in their willingness to chip in and take care of some of those duties, which gives the opportunity for the female to then go incubate another nest or what have you. So in years, we see really big population increases. We think it's probably because, for whatever reason, the males really are active that year. So they're really important to nesting and brood rearing.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yep.
All right. So again, folks that are maybe listening and following along online, bobscapes.org. Ryan, tell us about being a frequent user and your experience using the app so far.
Yeah, so I have used the app quite a bit. I've actually been back on our family farm in Nebraska the past couple weeks and actually recorded where I heard some bobwhites calling then. Really, the beauty of the app is how simple it is. I mean, you pull it up. There's three buttons there. If you don't know what a bobwhite sounds like, there's actually a recording of a bobwhite calling on there. There's a covey call on there, so you can familiarize yourself with that. Or maybe the landowner of the place where you hunt doesn't really familiar with quail, and it's a way that you can play that for them, and they can figure out what quail sound like, so they can participate as well. Because those are people I imagine that we're really wanting to participate as people who are out on the land every day. When you do hear a quail, I mean, the button literally says, "Hey, I hear Bob," and you press it. It grabs your location where you're at. It asks you very few questions. It's going to ask you your name. It's going to ask you for an email. It's going to ask you the time that you heard it. And then it's going to ask you if bobwhites were released around your area and if you physically saw any birds. I would say most people, once they use the app one time, I mean, it takes less than 30 seconds to make a recording. There was a couple times when my dad and I were having a conversation on the farm, and I heard a bobwhite, and I said, "Hold on a second." I plugged it in really quick, and you know, really didn't even interrupt our conversation. The other thing that's on the app is there's a map, and you can see where bobwhites have been recorded. And it doesn't tell people specifically where, like on our farm, but it will say, like, I think I got on this morning and there was around 100 for Nebraska. So really what I think of when I'm recording it, maybe it's not true, but I'm sort of advocating for my state, for people to know there are quail here and we need to take care of their habitat and we need to know more about their populations here. So it's a really useful app, very, very easy to use as well.
So I'm certain that there are dyed-in-the-wool quail hunters, you know, the skeptics among us that are like hell I'm going to register where I hear quail. Particularly on public ground, I don't want people knowing that, you know, it's having a sure. good year in pheasant or quail run, WMA. How do you answer that, Jess?
So we get this often and frequently. This isn't hot spotting. There's only 4 people or so that have access to the raw data on this. Anytime it's presented, it is buffered pretty liberally. So you can't find the exact location. Now, you know, in some states, it's a matter of scale. You know, Kansas versus Georgia, you can get a ballpark, you know, county, I'm sure. But really the map that's on the app itself is pretty random locations. Those aren't near exact at all. When the data comes in, it comes in as a nice Excel sheet. To me, that's how I see it. Dr. Martin gets at it a different way for modeling, but it's just lat longs of where it is. But like I said, even with our state agency partners, due to the restrictions placed on it by the USDA because they fund this, there's an importance in protecting personally identifiable information, even if the landowner is providing it on their own land. They're entrusting us to keep it quiet, essentially. But it's important to a lot of the users that they are participating in, you know, collecting data and participating in speaking to some of the implementation of the programs using the app. So for the most part, we're getting over a lot of that skepticism. And there is a frequently asked questions site or page on the website that you can look at that kind of addresses it and gets it into it a little bit more detail. But yeah, don't use this to find your next hunting spot. You'll be disappointed. But you might want to ask a local quail forever biologist for that.
James, anything you would add to that question about data and privacy?
You just covered. I mean, it's, you know, most states release some sort of quail outlook every year, and some of them have a map. This is no more dangerous than that to any local quail population as far as hotspotting goes. And, you know, I'll be honest, you're a baseball guy, you know, that famous quote about, you know, if you hit it, you can rename it kind of thing. Sometimes I feel like I could hand points on a map where I saw quail to a bird hunter and say, go at it. And those birds are the hardest to find, the ones that you actually see. Yeah. The ones that you see and hear, you know, most bird hunters know if they hear a covey calling or whatever and they try to hunt that bird, they almost never find it. I don't know what it is about that. I, you know, these are very much specific instances of seeing a quail and hearing a quail. Anything that the population level is aggregated in such a way that you're not going to be able to hotspot from it. So I'm a quail hunter, and I would be concerned if it could be used for that reason, and I'm totally not. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and Ryan, you basically pointed that out too. It's like you're seeing sort of a state-level aggregation, but you don't have any concerns of your own family farm being hotspotted when you're marking them down.
No, and I've actually got the app pulled up right now. I mean, it's literally just a state map of the U.S., and like Missouri, for example, you click Missouri and it just tells you how many quail have been heard or seen in the entire state of Missouri. So it's not even breaking it down by north, southwest county. It's just by state. So it really, there is nothing to lose. It's only, like I said, I always feel like every time I put one in, I'm like, that's another point for Nebraska for advocating for our home state quail.
All right, James, you talked to us a little bit earlier about how the data is going to be used long term. How many years worth of data before it's useful for? Is it already useful, or do you need a couple of years before graduate students are going to put it to use?
I think we'll start using it next year. The data will be integrated with other monitoring data. You know, right now we have 2,152 observations. So, and really that's a year of recording information, not even through two breeding seasons yet. And most of the detections will happen during the breeding season. So, you know, I don't know if that sounds like a lot to people or not, but that's 2,152 detections we didn't have. And so, again, adding that data on to other programs, data from other programs is going to make them all more powerful. So I think, you know, starting next year, we'll start including that in the models, and it'll just help refine, again, species distribution models for bobwhite and things like that.
Cool. Is that a big number in your mind, 2,500?
I wish it was more. I think there's some states that could be logging more data that hasn't been. I'm not going to call out their names, but you know, when people look at the map that's on the app and say, well, these two states have more than others, that's probably a function of activity of biologists and landowners more so than the number of quail. And when we go to model that, these data, that'll all be taken into consideration. But we need people in other states to step up and start using it. And, you know, that way we get a good picture of what's going on across our bobwhite range.
One other data point that I'm curious about is harvest numbers. You know, is that a data point that your grad students are going to use for geographic distribution as well?
No. We kind of kicked it around that a little bit But the problem with harvest information, that does get sensitive to hunters. When you, because to make that data really useful, we do need to know where the bird was killed.
Yeah, not just the state.
Not just the state. And as a bird hunter, I do get nervous when folks start asking me those questions. And also the whole pen raised versus wild bird complexity comes into play. So I don't know if the harvest data could be used effectively for that reason. So I don't have – that's not in the plans right now.
I'll round us towards close, and I'll ask each of you for kind of a closing remark. Before I go there, I just want to remind our listeners, particularly in the bobwhite quail range, please, as we're finishing up this episode, go to bobscapes.org on your phone and download the app. You know, because you, maybe you, next time you hear a bobwhite quail, you don't have the app downloaded, and it's just too easy not to register it. Download it now as you're finishing up the listening to this episode. Get it ready. Get it on your phone so you can help us figure out where there are birds across the landscape, where the habitat is keeping those birds on the landscape, and where we can put our focus for, as Jess mentioned, new biologists and new partnerships and working with landowners to create even better habitat with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Speaking of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, one final shout out to the Farming for Habitat campaign. It's a grant helping bring this episode to our listeners' ears, particularly the landowners employing private land conservation programs on their properties. Check out the campaign at farmingforhabitat.org. All right, closing thoughts. We'll go with Ryan, James, Jess. Ladies, get the last word. Ryan, what's your closing thought about bobscapes?
I don't know. I'm kind of looking at this map, and I mean, if you're in Georgia, Texas, Kansas, Missouri, I mean, I'm a competitive person. I mean, I'd be. You guys are all in the lead by far. So we got to bring it up in Nebraska. But I will just say too, you know, I brought it up as almost like a competition, but really, you know, it might seem like an insignificant thing to get on there and record that you saw a bobwhite or heard a bobwhite. But I mean, that's really why we're members of an organization like Quail Forever. Like, my one membership by itself maybe doesn't mean that much, but together collectively, we have a stronger voice for quail. And I think it's the exact same thing for this app. So it might not seem worth it to take the time and take the app out, but really it's as quick as sending a text. And, you know, that's going to lead to more research and better habitat and ideally more quail on the ground in the future. So I'd encourage people to use the app as much as they can.
Yeah, right on. Well said. Dr. Martin, how would you like to close up this episode?
Well, I'll just make mention that the comments that people type in the app are really entertaining and informative. So please continue to do that. I'm just looking at some of them now. I've got it open. This person just describes that they saw the covey breaking roost. So I'm a very, I draw pictures in my head, and, you know, so I, in my mind, someone's there walking their dog or drinking their coffee, and they saw a covey get off the roost and fly off. And that's pretty cool that they thought to record that. This one, young covey landed in the fence row. Was doing some strip disking for control burns this spring. You know, just things like that are really neat to hear, and kind of goes back to, this is not just a science tool, it's a way to engage people. And so I think the comments are one way to do that. So please continue to type those out, and yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah, there's somebody reading them and paying attention on the other side and drawing visuals in their mind. Yeah. That's pretty cool to hear. Yeah. Jess, closing thoughts, they're all yours.
Yeah, so great, great mentioning of the comments. That's also something that's been great, good and bad, you know, lamenting over conservation efforts and things like that. You know, we've even used some of those comments in presentations to say, hey, this is the public, you know, they love the birds, they want to see them back. So yeah, super useful. And I'm really happy to see that we do have, you know, input and documented from 21 states, you know, for such a young app and for a group of us that, like James says, it's our first rodeo and app building. I think we're doing pretty good. Could probably be doing a little bit better, but, you know, it's going to take effort to, you know, really get the word out. And now I feel like we're comfortable with it. We've got a good plan moving forward to get, you know, be contacting people and getting things out. So I think you're going to see Bobscapes really improve a lot, and usage will increase, and, you know, just be part of the solution. And that, you know, we've created something to try to engage more people because we want quail hunters, their voice needs to be heard, you know, and it's a small group, but it's definitely a mighty and can be loud group. We've heard them before. So this is just one small way to contribute to everything that we've got going on the ground to, you know, save more habitat and make sure we've all got birds that our bad dogs can go chase. And, you know, there's no such thing as a bad dog, right, James? My dog is not bad. She's just a little wild.
You know, the embrace of citizen science, engaging landowners, engaging quail hunters in the science is critically important in 2024 and beyond. You know, just thinking about the, you know, the 20 years that Quail Forever has been around, there's momentum right now. There's momentum in the last 2 years that there hasn't been before, and that's continuing to escalate. And this is a way to help us continue to build that momentum. You know, let's go from 2,500 up to 25,000 and beyond, 2.5 million. Let's get lots of data points on the landscape. There are a lot more quail out there than 2,500, and there are a lot more people that care about them than 2,500. So let's blow this up. Bobscapes.org. Good dog, bad dog, mediocre dog. Always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.